On this week's show, can AI be the brain of your construction project with Dr. Sarah Buckner from Trunk Tools? In this week's news, meet the robots aimed at solving the global labor shortage. And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back. Another episode. Rob McKinney riding along with me today. It's good to see you again, my man. Two in a row here.
It's good to be along with you in the sidecar, Iron Man. It's always fun to have awesome conversations with new people.
Yeah, and on that note, Dr. Sarah Buckner's joining us today. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. This is going
to
be fun.
It's great to have you. I'm excited to get in and dive into what you are. Where are you coming to us from today?
New York. It's sweating New York.
New York City, where it is hot and humid, right?
Yes.
Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@theconTechCrew.com to learn more. Good day to be in an office, though. It's a good day for you guys to be driving in your cars, listening in wherever you're listening to us from. Thanks for stepping in and joining us. Sarah, we always start the show with a background. And from the minute I met you and kind of did some research, you have a really interesting history. So tell everybody a little bit of how you're connected with construction and maybe a little pathway to where you are today.
Yeah, I feel like most people in construction, I'm in this industry completely involuntarily. Like, I've hardly ever met people who actually were like, I wanted to be a construction person. So I grew up in a fairly poor environment, and for us to, you know, make more money as a family, my dad was a carpenter, and so he decided to put the kids with him on the job sites to just, you know, double, triple salaries there. And so I started on my first job site when I was 12 as a carpenter. I was trained before, obviously, like there's pictures of me being 6 years old working in a workshop in perfect PPE with like the Birkenstocks that are cool nowadays, but definitely were not cool as a child. And so like started working pretty much full time as a carpenter in my young teenage years, and then never stopped, because as much as I didn't want to do this initially, I actually really, really fell in love with it. It's a very unique industry. It's very honest. It is no BS. It is producing real haptic things, and it's just fascinating to actually produce something that you can touch and use. And I actually always say, which people don't know, the most consumed product in the world is construction. Because every single person, even people in the cars right now, you are consuming a highway or a street, which is also construction, right? We consume construction 24/7. It's like only air is like something you consume more. It's air and then it's construction. Started as a carpenter, worked my way up, became a foreman, super, switched over to the GC side because I thought that's where the power and the money is. Then I realized, no, it's actually in the owner side, but I stayed as a GC. Ran larger and larger construction sites, and eventually I was doing a fairly big job. I had 600 guys working for me, and we had a fatality on the job. And that was really a point in my career where I was very young, and I was very obviously emotionally heartbroken, and I wanted to change something. And so I built and created a health and safety app because I wanted to see less people die. And that was really my switch from actual construction over to construction tech before it was really a term. I think kind of like a little bit before you guys started this podcast. So thanks for making it a thing. And it was also back in the days when apps were cool. And so, yeah, you know, it's like not nowadays, nobody does apps anymore. But yeah, did health and safety app, and then fell more and more into the space, did some education in the space. I finished a PhD in AI and construction. And this was still like at a time when AI was not cool and nobody wanted to talk about it and nobody wanted to share data. And it was a crazy time. And yeah, eventually I had a startup in Europe and I decided I wanted to come to the best country in the world. and best country and best economy, definitely. And so I made my way to the US, and I was lucky enough to get into Stanford, and that's why we're here today. Started a company here and now have the pleasure to talk to people like you.
So we have to go back into the beginning. Okay. So the accent, you know, you had to know it. So where was home? Where did all this start?
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Unfortunately, the accent doesn't go away, but the accent originally is from the countryside of Austria. I think about a 700 people village. We had more cows than people, and I originally grew up on a farm. So I know how to milk a cow and build a house.
We were having a pre-call discussion that, you know, here in the States, you couldn't even have been, dad couldn't have really even taken you. Although I think maybe back then you could have snuck him onto the job site,
yeah.
But that you really can't, you can't do that anymore. But it's crazy to see, you know, between the, you know, working on a farm and working in carpentry and then deciding you want to continue and get educated, because you did go to school along the way, even before the GC and before the big job with the 600 people, right?
Yeah. I mean, the cool thing is there's two things in Europe that, you know, are easier than I think in the US. It is like, education is for free and you actually don't have to show up for most of the education. You just have to show up for the exams. And so at least in the countryside, right? And so like, that's how it worked for me. Like I've worked full time for like almost during all my schooling time, right? Because it would just show up for the exams, and it was thankfully like I was really good at reading, so I could just like digest data and then like show up for the exams and pass them. But I almost got kicked out in my first week of Stanford because it was the first time that I had something called an attendance policy, and I had no idea what that was, and I didn't take it seriously. And so a week into my Stanford business school, they called me up and was like, hey, you haven't showed up to like X amount of classes. And I was like, yeah, of course not. I'm building a business. They were like, yeah, no. You have to show up here. I'm like, okay. So yeah, well, wouldn't have worked here probably.
No. But I mean, I kind of like to show that, because it shows that you can do both things at the same time, and that there's this middle ground between people who are learning in the real world and, you know, can still educate themselves, and they need the paper, right? If you know it and you know the context and you know the content, then the paper is what you need for that next step and roles over time. So why not just go that way? It's kind of,
I also think education ultimately is to, you know, for me, it was always to make me, for me, originally was to get out of poverty, right? There was two paths for me that thankfully my parents taught me, which was like hard work and education. And I was like, cool, let me do both, right? And so I did both. And the piece around education for me, it was like, hey, education needs to fuel my work, right? It needs to fuel my professional success. And so therefore, I remember some classes in like civil engineering, construction management, right? I was so much better than my classmates because I managed the construction site as my main job, right? And it wasn't because I was smarter. It was just like we discussed whatever contracts or negotiating with subcontractors. Like I have done this for 3 years, right? Like I don't need to like study the theory behind it. And so I really feel we are missing out as a society sometimes thinking about education as just like such a broad thing. But if you take it very targeted, it actually can fuel your job and vice versa.
Construction in general is a highly stressful environment, and you see the stress and you always get the I'm fine answer, but always try to dig a little deeper, because people say, you know, I haven't been sleeping great, and I'm really eating crappy food, and I feel anxious, I feel depressed, I feel, you know, we'll start to really get into those conversations and figure out what's going on. There's some great resources, and if you go to brentdarnell.com/resources, first, there's an emotional intelligence and physical symptoms survey test. So we get your emotional profile and we get your physical profile based on physical symptoms, and we tell how your body's working. And then we can correlate those two. And if you're experiencing burnout, it will show up in probably both of those evaluations. It's free. You just download it and do it. And just so see where you are. And if burnout's the top two or three that pop up and show up there, I would pay attention. And start to really look at what are you doing with stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise and daily reflection and those kinds of things that we know we need to do to keep us healthy and keep us sane and keep us on track.
You've got to check in with where you are. You've got to work on balancing. It's not about the diagnosis. It's about preventing people from getting too far down the road. Like most of our construction folks that listen in, they take care of their cars. They keep them up to date. You know, this is no different. You've got to put in the maintenance on the body, on the mind, because you're racing this car around the track, right? We're not going to change that we're a bunch of race cars out there, but we can change that we do the right maintenance, take the right time, and really check in.
One more resource in there, the Tough Guy Survival Kit, guy being gender neutral. It's specifically written geared toward more field folks, but there's a really great chapter on stress management and peak performance in there, and it talks about meditation techniques and mindfulness techniques and breathing techniques.
I want to take you on to next, a PhD in AI 10 years ago.
In construction. Yeah.
In construction.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. I mean, you're right. This show started around then, and we were just trying to introduce people to the cloud, to apps, and you're back there trying to study this. So what was that experience like? And maybe take it to a fast forward to today, because it's, I mean, people thought it was new. I mean, it didn't all start with OpenAI 2 years ago. It's older than that.
You know, it's OpenAI, you know, like large language models and all of that stuff. Generative AI is not all of AI, and ML is part of it. Like, it's just like so much bigger than what we are now talking about. Thanks to OpenAI, they did the marketing for all of us. So like that's good, but it's way bigger than a little ChatGPT. Yeah, how it started. I always had like phenomenal mentors along the way. I have to admit that I would never be where I am without like people just, you know, being 10, 20 years ahead of the career and be like, hey, Sarah, here is how you do this and here's how you do that. And so I had a mentor who was like a CEO of one of the biggest general contractors in the world. And they kind of like financed my PhD. And so I asked him, it was like, what should I be doing in my PhD, right? And the reason even why I did the PhD was because they told me in Europe, hey, we want to make you the first female C-suite member, right? We want to push you up the corporate ladder. We want you to be first woman representing one of these general contractors in a C-level role. But in order to do that, you need a PhD. It's very European, right? It's like the US MBA in Europe is a PhD. So I was like, cool, if you want me to do a PhD to get up there, like you pay for it. So that was the deal. So then they paid for the PhD and I was like, hey, given that you're paying for it, like what do you want me to actually study? And they were like, hey, you know, there's like disruption and there's AI and there's all this data that we have in construction, but we don't know what to do with it. Like, study that. And so it wasn't my idea, but I was like, that sounds smart. Like, data is a thing, right? And so I went down that rabbit hole and it was interesting because the company that paid for the PhD paid a ton of money, and I'm talking like millions, into cleaning data so that I can do something with the data as a researcher. And that is, you know, unreasonable in the natural world. Like, nobody can actually do this. And so that's like stupid research is like how I want to call it. That's research that can only be done in a vacuum that has nothing to do with reality. But that's what I did. And so now fast forward, you know, like 10 years, the AI and especially generative AI has gotten so much better in actually structuring unstructured data that now some of the research I did in a vacuum is now possible in reality because the computational power has gone up, because the tools and the technologies that were developed for totally different industries have gone up and can now be used and brought back into construction and really, really change what's possible. And that's why I started this company like a few years ago. And that's what we're doing now.
That is a fascinating background to understand, Sarah. First, thank you for your story. Hearing your origin story, I got to be honest, there's so many people that I've met in the construction industry. Normally, let's be honest, it'd be from the male side of the table of so many superintendents and PMs and business owners talking about working with their dad, working with their uncle, working with their grandfather. I have heard several women say this, but like I said, that ratio, your story, my hat is off to you. That's amazing to hear that. Please, as much as you can share your story, I think it'll help inspire so many other girls to think about it, where I'm thinking about my daughter. She's 11 years old. What is she going to do someday? I have no idea. I'm trying to make sure that she has that open mindset that I'm not pushing her to go to college. I'm not pushing her to go to trade school or pastry school, whatever she wants to do, but to be open-minded. That example, that's amazing to hear.
I can tell you what AI can automate knowledge jobs, you know, what it cannot automate, trades jobs. So my plan B is if all of this goes up, you know, like I'll just gonna go back be a carpenter.
Hitting nails is hitting nails, right? There's
the hammer. No robots yet. Yeah.
No. Well, with the mindset that you're bringing to the industry, I'm curious, you have literally watched this industry digitize. And Jeff and I are always kind of joking about, yeah, like we're still kind of think we're at the forefront of digitizing. So how have you really been approaching this mindset of it's, quote, time to digitize in 2024 of you're trying to help automate workflows. But when you're going to a company that maybe, like you were talking earlier, if they're still not bought into apps, how are you having a conversation about AI in 2024?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I think we're just not having a conversation about AI. We're having a conversation about which problems we are solving without actually explaining how we are solving it. And I think it's how it's a general discussion around product market fit and how you start as a startup, right? Like we are very focused on problems. We're not focused on throwing a technology against the market. And I think what's was so hard in construction over since when we started even talking about digitization, whatever, 20 years ago, was always everybody thinks we have a lot of data, but it's very hard to use it. And what's beautiful about what we have now is that generative AI can structure unstructured data. And that's what we're doing at Trunkflows, right? We take all of the crap that comes in here, right? Like all of this unstructured mess of data. And I always love to bring this example here. Rob and Jeff, a question. When you have an average high-res, $500 million high-res project, you want to take a guess of how many pages of documentation you need to build a high-res with, you know, whatever, 30 floors. And with pages, I mean RFIs and submittals and schedules and blueprints and like everything that you have on a project management system. Do you want to take a guess of how many pages of documentation you have?
It's got to be thousands in reality, where in a perfect world, it's probably hundreds, but then humans get involved. It's got to be thousands, tens of thousands.
I did the pre-call, so I'm not allowed to answer on this one. Rob, this is okay. All on you.
Ooh.
When we launched this first version, like over a year ago, we received from a Suffolk construction site in New York. It was a $500-ish million job. We received 3.6 million pages of documentation.
Wow.
On a single job.
What
the GC promises the owner, don't worry, I've built this exactly as specified on 3.6 million pages. Like, it's insanity and it's humanly impossible, right? And like, I think digitization and construction has actually made this problem worse, because while everything was paper and, you know, like we actually had to mail stuff around, like you try to like really get it right on the blueprint on version one and so on. Then, you know, digitization came around. It's so much easier. Everything emails, like blah, 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 right? And it creates an amount of data that is completely unreasonable and humanly impossible. And what's beautiful about AI, what we do is, right, we take all the data and put it into, like, we structure it, but the AI structures it. So now what we are creating is, like, a data graph, a knowledge graph of all of the different data points out of 3.6 million pages. And I don't care what the input is. I don't care if it's a scanned PDF or a handwritten anything or, like, a 3D Revit file. We take all of this down, and then we give it back to the human semantically. And what I mean with semantically is like through either like verbally or through text messages or so on, right? Like you have to take away all of what we call digitization over the last 10, 20 years with a complicated UI, and you have to train somebody and bring it back to what the human needs. I need a piece of information now. And the way a human receives a piece of information, it's through a sentence, through, you know, like whatever way of communicating, but make it as simple as possible. And that's why I'm not worried about people not wanting to adopt AI. It's really like, do you want to text Trunkflows like, hey, like, you know, whatever, like, what's the color of the wall in the lobby? And within a few seconds, we tell you it's Benjamin Moore, black, white, whatever. Do you want that? Or do you want a complicated UI where you need to find something and you need to figure out how to do your job? Like,
yeah, well, I want to tie that back. Like that's first of all, I went and found the building. Just so happens I was there. I had seen it and you did it on stage somewhere and I saw it and I'm like, I happen to be close by and I'm like, I have to go see this. Like I have to look at this in person because this just blows my mind. And it so that was quite fun. Thanks for the tour of heading down there to see it. But this ties back to your beginnings of actually working in the field and understanding what it is that you need to get done and focusing not on, I don't care how we're doing it all, right? How's not important. Even sometimes why's not why's important, but you know, making it easy. You know, it's not about if it, I don't really care if it's AI or 10,000 people programming in the background. Gas goes in my engine and I don't question that when I hit the gas, it does what I'm supposed to do. I just know that when I hit the gas and brake, it does what I want it to do. But you said, Sarah, that you started with the problem. So what are the biggest problems facing contractors in your mind that are really driving you? Because I don't think you're going to end up back in the field building necessarily, because I think you've got a lot of things to build for the future. What are those core problems and you know, what are you doing about them and how are you approaching it? Because there's a lot of them.
Yeah. I think at the high level is that we are hiring people. We have a labor shortage, right? No doubts. And so then we find a few people that are willing to work in construction, right? And we hire people who want to build, they want to create, right? That's the type of persona that is becomes a superintendent or a PM or, you know, whatever whatever position in construction. They're people who want to create and build. These are not people who want to be victims of bureaucracy. And like, you know, their whole purpose of life is not to write an RFI at 6 p.m. instead of going home to their family, right? And so that's really like our focus is to use technology to augment the humans in the field so they can focus back on doing what they A, want to do and B, should be doing, which is create the building and, you know, manage the people. And all the other stuff, for the lack of a more appropriate word here, right? All the other stuff can be automated by machines. I really do not need somebody to create an RFI. I do not need somebody to compare a submittal with a spec, like an AI can do that, right? I don't need somebody to, when they're trying to figure out so we have a bunch of agents out there, right? Like AI agents. Just giving you an example here for like a schedule agent. Our schedule agent, and an agent is nothing else than an AI-based workflow. Our schedule agent by itself sits on top of the schedule and looks forward and is like, okay, like, hey, you're supposed to pour concrete on floor 2 next week. Let me actually screen if there is an order form. Let me screen if there's open RFIs. Let me screen if there's data points in this massive amount of data that will let me assume that you're not going to pour concrete next week on floor 2. And then if that's the case, let me actually alert the right people at the right time and like, hey, please close this RFI so we can keep on the critical path, right? That's the kind of stuff that an AI can do. It's an assistant for you. And we have many of these assistants out there that works for you 24/7 passively, pretty much without cost. It's as if you have like hundreds of people working for you, right? Like if I had 100 executive assistants like that, think like that. That's what we're creating.
And that's the true power of it, is that it clears up builders, people, those superintendents, those foremen who are so connected to all the other problems we have going on in construction, not just the RFIs and the change orders and, you know, does the spec match? It's, look, is my crew here? Are they safe? Are they focused? There's so many things that they can be focused on the project and instead of in the paperwork, in the bureaucracy, in the trailer, not looking around.
Exactly.
And, and that's the key.
We did a study on a job site. We had like a, you know, an intern out there stopping times of like, you know, like how do people actually like general contractors, how do they spend time? 8% of it was in the field. 8%. Okay. Do you want to guess what was the biggest?
16%
was discrepancies in data.
16%?
Okay. 16 times spent. 16% every day. Like, oh, the plan doesn't match the spec, doesn't blah, blah, blah. Which is AI can take care of that, right? Like when our AI already does that, it's like, hey, your RFIs is something different than the specs, doesn't match the blueprints and so on, right? So 16% goes in plan discrepancies and document discrepancies. And another like 15% in just searching for the right information. Another 13% meeting prep, right? So we're talking almost half of their time they spent between prepping of our meetings, searching for information, and figuring out discrepancies in the data. This is half of the day. and only 8% is spent in the field, which is quality control, safety control, you know, everything that we actually think we're paying the GC for.
So the workflow you're talking about, I think it's a mindset shift. How do you work with your customers on doing a mindset shift with those project managers, the supers, the foremans, anybody that might actually be using this new technology, to trust the tech to be an assistant versus the old mental model of, and I remember 20 years ago being told, I'm a super because I know how to be a super and you don't know how to be a super. How do you shift that mindset to trust the tech?
It's a very good question. I like to compare it with navigation systems. When we started like with GPS, you know, like Google Maps or something like that, when this technology came out, it would tell you like how to get from A to B, right? And like that would be almost pre-coded in a way, right? And you, most people are like, you know, like I'm double checking, probably I know a faster way, whatever. Over time, it got more data, right? It got life data, and we're like, hey, you know, I actually can calculate the fastest route based on some inputs fields. So like, okay, that was the second step. What has happened nowadays, right? Like, we are driving with these things. While I'm driving, it's telling me like, oh, by the way, I'm rerouting you to the left because there's some traffic jam, and we just blindly follow. Have you ever like checked? Do you even know if there's a traffic jam? Or maybe McDonald's is paying somebody, so I drive by McDonald's to the left. Like, we don't know, right? Like, we have absolutely no idea why it's rerouting me, and we're never checking, and we're blindly following an AI agent in one of the most important things that we do, which is driving, right? To every listener out there that is probably right now, 90% of you are using Waze, Google Maps, something like that, and just blindly following the rerouting. That is an AI agent. And we've slowly gotten people there, and I think we're getting more and more used to believing and trusting the technology, and that's something that is going to happen in construction. So it's a step-by-step process.
That'll be interesting to see how that actually happens, because your analogy is brilliant, right? Of, I use, as my dad referred to it, Waze all the time. And I use it a lot. I live around Atlanta, and I've got a pretty good gut of like, this sounds right, but there are those weird false positives. So every now and then, with how they re-updated a lot of the infrastructure in Atlanta, there'll be an off-ramp 2 miles ahead of time now that I don't know how the maps getting updated. So every now and then, it's telling me to get off way early, and I'm thinking, nah, there's no reason for that. I live here. I know this, and I don't know the ratio. It's probably, let's say the majority of the time, it was still probably accurate. But to your point, when I'm traveling, if I'm not around Atlanta and I'm using the traffic app, I have to put that blind faith in it. Like, yeah, it definitely knows that there's a wreck or there's a better way to get there. But for a tradesman that's been building for 20, 30 years, a project manager that's been doing it, boy, that's got to be a hard, unsettling feeling for them to not trust what's in their brain, their quote, gut instinct, and really put that power of belief behind technology. Maybe I'm crazy.
I don't think it is like, you know, making them believe something else than they believe, right? I think it's just helping them to get there faster, which is the same thing that like a Google Maps does, right? And I always tell, when I hear companies like, you know, then answering usually, or they worry about like, oh, but nobody knows nowadays anymore how to read a map, right? I'm like, yes. And nobody needs it anymore, right? But also, like, if the CEO of a trucking company 10 years ago, would you have really told your people to not use a navigation system? Like, you couldn't, because you couldn't have stayed competitive. And it's the same thing that's happening right now in AI, right? Like, you will not be able to stay competitive if you don't jump on this, because your humans get augmented with this technology. We actually call it IA internally instead of AI, which is intelligence augmentation instead of artificial intelligence. And that's really what it is, right? We are intelligently augmenting the human, and they turn into superhumans. Like, some of our superintendents, literally, we have quotes from them saying like, this feels like a cheat tool. Like, I'm the smartest person on the job. I win every negotiation against our subcontractors, against the owner, right? And so if people start adopting this, and they are, like, how do you want to stay competitive? Like, you have to jump on this train. Like, that's just how a capitalist environment works. Welcome to the United States of America.
Well, and a couple things there. So I go back to when Waze was out in the beginning, and I didn't trust it either. And I was headed somewhere with my buddy, and we said, no, we don't want to take that route. We're going to stay on the highway. It's faster. Yeah, 3.5 hours later showed up because there was no way to get where we should have gone. So I confirmed the traffic was there. And since I put it in and Waze tells me where to go, and I'm like, way to go, Waze. I'm going where you want me to go. because I saw what happens when you don't. But what I think is interesting about what you're doing and what Trunk Tools is doing is they're actually, you are, if I ask those questions, say about a chiller or something, you're actually not only surfacing it, you can show me where you got it, right? They can get to it faster. So it's not a blind faith. I mean, maybe in some of the, well, not even in the schedule agent perspective, right? The schedule agent says you're going to
give you the document. That's how construction works. Yes, absolutely. Well,
that's what I wanted to get out of you.
I was like, when I was a superintendent, I wouldn't have trusted it. I was like, no, I still want to see the original document because in the end, my boss is going to yell at me, right? So like, I need to like make sure because I can't yell back at the AI, like maybe in the future, right? But right now, like that just doesn't work. So.
Well, and here's the thing is that's in your math, like 35 to 40% of your time back trying to find data or preparing and trying to fix data. Everybody will take, let's go low. It's 30% of your time. Everybody will take 30% of the worst part of your day back to ask for the things that you need. And oh, by the way, give you the ones that you didn't see because somebody generated an RFI or a detail or something that was in 3.6 million files and you missed it. And probably wasn't even there. It was in an email somewhere. And now you can look at it.
Sorry to interrupt. My favorite part about this actually is when we think about rework, right? Which like still, I love when I talk to non-construction people. Have you, by the way, ever thought about this? You're either in construction or you're not. There's not this like gray zone of you're kind of interested in construction. Like that just doesn't exist, right? It's like everybody's kind of interested in healthcare, but like in construction, it's like either you're in or you're out. So if you talk to people, and I have to do this a lot because I, you know, Silicon Valley, venture capital, all of this stuff. So talk to people who are not in construction and then tell them, hey, we build a $500 million high rise. We have a budget that has like thousands of line items. And then there's one line item that says rework and it says $50 million. And then you have these people who are like, wait, what? Like, why can I have one line item that is 10% of the overall cost? And it's just completely undefined. And we're like, because we know as an industry, we're going to mess up, right? And we're going to mess up 10% of the time and 10% of the cost. And then there's a new study that was done a little bit ago that showed that 65% of rework, so about 6.5% of the overall construction cost on average, is because of data discrepancies. Okay. So in a $100 million project, you are spending $6.5 million because of data discrepancies.
I actually saw that and was blown away by it. But I can remember before where the technology is today, how hard and expensive it was to try to, like, it was almost like an arms race. Like, do I spend it on the data or do I spend it on the, on the rework. And it's like, well, I'm really good at rework and getting that money. So that's a guarantee. So we're just going to keep that here. But what's awesome about what the technology advancement has done and the tool advancement has done is now it doesn't cost me the same amount of money. It doesn't cost me 10% of my project cost, maybe 5% of my project cost to get the data right. Now for what can be a really reasonable cost to do this, we can prevent a ton of rework. And on top of rework is also the most, and Rob, you'll love this, it's usually the most dangerous.
Yes, it is.
Because you're talking about chipping out concrete. You're talking about working in above your head doing that in really dangerous space where.
And it's rushed.
It's rushed. It's all. Oh, no, we always have plenty of time for rework, right? Don't we leave a whole bunch in the schedule with that 10%? We leave 10% of the schedule for rework, don't we?
I've never actually heard that yet.
No, we take 10% out and know we're still going to do 10% more work than we scheduled to do. And we know we scheduled wrong anyway, with a little bit too compressed. So no, we don't do that. So yeah, it's rushed. Sometimes it's even, you know, a lot of the building is, you know, there's working utilities inside of the building at this point. And that can cause great disruption to other crews. You got crew stacking. I mean, there's a ton of things in here. So
right, if you think about a 3 to 4% margin of whatever GCs have right now on average, like if you can triple your margin by just reducing the rework data discrepancy piece, like
did you say they can make more money? Because you know, yeah. we're going to have to cut that. We're not allowed to say that any of us are in construction to be profitable and make money. We're here because we love it and we're not allowed to leave, right? Isn't that
now? Yeah, we like to be revenue neutral.
Sarah, is there a way you could actually create visuals for what you're talking about with cleaning up data? And Jeff, what I'm thinking about is there was a time way back when, right, that BIM wasn't popular and people couldn't wrap their mind around BIM. And when you actually started showing these digital clashes, because back in the day, clash detection was easy. When the beam didn't fit because it wasn't lined up right, it didn't fit and you had a problem. Then it was like, well, what if we drew it up early? Then we could see it. But now, Sarah, based on what you're talking about, how do you come up with some visuals to show to owners, to estimators, to PMs and say, you know, like, here's what a messy data pool looks like versus here's what a clean, pure stream looks like with those dollar signs attached? Like, how do you get to their gray matter to really understand what you're talking about?
I think it's almost a little too early for me to perfectly visualize that without creating a complete BS here. But I think what's more powerful around, and I appreciate you bringing this up, is when you, I was the biggest fan of BIM, okay? I ran one of the biggest BIM construction sets in Europe. They gave me $10 million to create a BIM model that actually works for facility management. Great, right? It was like one of these shiny projects. But the problem is really like BIM failed a little bit, right? Like, and this is polarizing, I know. And like a bunch of people are going to hang up right now. And I'm sorry about that, Jeff. But the problem with why BIM has failed is because the financial incentives to create a good BIM are not aligned with the person that needs to make that decision, right? And so like the people who make the money and not the people who have to pay the money for BIM. And it's ultimately in our very separated, segregated industry that will forever be true. And that's why we will never actually be able to do good, complete BIM the way we should be doing it in traditional projects, the fancy ones, whatever, right? The 5%. But talk about the 95% of construction. What BIM intended to do was to get the information from the owner or the architect or whoever makes the decision down to the actual tradesperson who has to execute, right? And try to create all the clash detections in the middle. And the way they did it was through a 3D model, which I think was a great idea, just really, really expensive to actually pull it off. What we are doing right now is we take all the data, we create a knowledge graph, and like a data model for the ease of terminology. We create a data model without the 3D visualization, and then let a human semantically interact with the data. So the tradesperson still gets the same answer, but from a pure data model without the 3D. So what we are actually doing, we're creating the same data structure as BIM tried, but without the 3D model, and therefore way, way cheaper. So I for me personally, it's like that's a way to do BIM without a 3D model, and that's probably way more feasible for the 95% of construction sites that cannot afford like a BIM coordinator and like all of the, you know, the additional BIM costs that you have.
It's a great analogy. You make a really good point, because the eye is the one that's always been forgotten in BIM. It's an information model.
Yes.
Right. It's a building information model. And, you know, we go all the way back, you know, to the early days of this and realizing everybody, I think the problem with BIM is everybody's trying to do BIM everything. And it's like 3D model everything. And that's not the importance of it.
But wait, BIM, there's no 3D model. It's building information model.
Information model. Yes.
The model doesn't say 3D model. We have a data model.
Yeah, there's needs for certain parts of it for fabrication or for, you know, somewhat of clash detection if we can use it. But if we can dial back what we need to 3D model to the core pieces that need to be 3D modeled, we can cut those costs back. And if we can get everything else that we're trying to, because if you look at these models, they're trying to jam everything into it, right? And most of it can't even be used by owners. Like, you're not only are you right that only about 5% of those can really pull it off, those 5%, probably only 2.5% of them can even use it. Yeah. Right. They actually then need it in some other format, in a format like you're asking. Because if I'm getting this right, you now have a data model to hand over that's truly the information behind the building that a facilities management person can ask and can work with in the handover. So I'm really interested in how, you know, you see this changing the paradigm and maybe where Trunk Tools is today and where your mind is today. And I know Rob's going to enjoy this. Where are you going next? Like, where do you see this going?
The beauty is that we have now a building information model without the 3D component. We have the data model, which what we call it, the brain behind construction, right? So we take all your data on a specific job, we fine tune and train the AI for that job, right? So you have this magnificent brain that works for you in the background for your job site that knows more about the job than all the architects and owners and PMs together, that is better on executing on most thing because it can work 24/7 with a, you know, energy that's really just reliant on GPUs and NVIDIA, and that's fine. And so it is where we see this going is that we can drastically reduce rework by at least 65% because all of that is just data discrepancy. And we can drastically reduce like the hours that people have to waste for the non-actually value-adding work in a job site, which is all the bureaucracy, right? Like I think there's a lot of value-adding stuff people doing, and then there's all the other stuff. And we just like, right now, we're just automating one of these workflows at a time with a different AI agent. And all of these agents or assistants are powered by this brain that we've built and trained for each construction site. Now think about it, instead of you're starting a new job and you need to have 20 people show up there, maybe you'll just have a few people show up there and the rest is done by AI. And those few people can actually stay safe and do a job that is fulfilling and not write RFIs in the middle of the night.
We waste so much time of these incredible craftspeople doing, you know, accounting work for us and filling timesheets out and filling things out and checking another form and wearing them out. And so it's an opportunity. And there is a fear, and I like the way you approach it. There is a fear that, you know, these AI agents are going to, you know, take our jobs. But you said it, they're not there to take our jobs. The person that's going to take your job and the construction company that's going to take your next and win the next project is one powered with these AI agents because they're efficient, they're effective, and they're focused on the future of the project and delivering for the owners. Like that's the beautiful thing is if we can eliminate rework, if we can eliminate a lot of the bureaucracy, what can we really do? We can sit across with the owner and learn more about what they value and what they want out of the project and make sure we deliver at the highest level for them. Because that is the one thing like the agent can't do. The agent can tell us what to do in the field, but it can't tell us what the owner cares about and what they want out of the project. And so it's giving us a way to do it.
It's like, think about it, right? If you want to get from A to B quickly and you hire an Uber driver, you're going to ask the person to drive with Google Maps or something like that, right? You're not going to drive with somebody, if you want to go fast and be safe, you're not going to drive with somebody who doesn't use technology to get you there. So that's the same thing. Like it is slowly starting. Like we started very much with the GCs because they usually have the bigger innovation departments and they're more like tech adaptive. So we started with them. Actually, I think subcontractors are really forward thinking as well. And now we slowly see that the owners are catching up. We have insurance companies starting using our AI, right? And this is when it gets interesting, right? Because once we are in those scenes, then it's like, hey, the owner doesn't want you to not work with AI, right? Because the owner actually is the one caring that this building gets built fast and efficiently and so on. And so, well, I will always get back to my example. Like if you want to get from A to B really quickly, you want somebody who is technologically advanced. And that's where we are in construction.
That's perfectly said. I think, Rob, I think we found our mic drop moment. Sarah, thank you so much for sitting down with us. You're going to stay with us. You're going to ride through the construction technology news of the week, which will, I think, have some things right up your alley. So Rob, tell me what you got for the construction technology news of the week.
All right, I was trolling around this week and landed on ENR for a little bit. So the first one that I found is technologies that rapidly transform construction will change job sites. Okay, I think we've seen that title a little bit, but as we're getting through the conversation we just had, there's a few things that are pointed out on here, Jeff, to get your feedback on. And we're talking about putting technology on sites. The first one is multi-cloud supports business interoperability. It's 2024, and before the show, we were still kind of joking and talking about, there are still some of our friends in construction that still have on-premise, a lot of on-premise stuff, right? And this mythical cloud they're not quite there yet, but how would you break that concept down to somebody of multi-cloud supports when we're talking about all this technology that we use? How do you get somebody over that chasm, that hump in that genre of technology?
It's an interesting one, but it's basically just saying, listen, if I move to the cloud, but I just keep it separate, it's not going to work. And this is a little bit of an older, this is one of those ones where you're like, really? We're still talking about this one? Because, I mean, multi-cloud is a lot of what you do here, right? You use your Google to log into things, or your Microsoft. You picked your identity provider, whichever one it is, and then you ride along with that. And it gets to share certain amounts of data between the two. So I think it gets, for me, it's more about interoperability, kind of what Sarah and the team are focused on, is because, look, we've got to share information. Nothing in what we do in our world and it happens in a vacuum. So, it's time. But what I thought was really interesting about your article, Rob, that I kind of want to ask Sarah about is data security. Yeah. One of the things that's really critical, and it is why I have to, you know, I've seen a couple of presentations around what can happen if the wrong information about a building gets out to the general public. So I'm interested in that security first mindset and the need for security in these types of applications. So Sarah, what's kind of the focus for you guys on that and your take on it?
I mean, we were all about it from day one because we were an enterprise first startup. What that means is that our first few customers were large enterprise customers, which the only way you can do this as a small company is if you raise enough venture capital pretty much to build it out to a point where it's enterprise ready, and then you can get the big guys first. Why I cared about that is because it's way easier to go big small than small big because of all of these questions, right? It depends on how you build your architecture and how you build your data security standards and everything like that. So we are a SOC 2 type 2 compliant, and you know, all these certifications and all of these standards that we built in from day one, it is super important. There's lots of fear in the market, which is quite interesting, and we have so many policies and explicit additional papers and everything that we sign with customers just explaining, like, hey, just because it says AI somewhere doesn't mean your data will get sent to ChatGPT and, like, you know, your biggest competitor can just figure everything out about you. So there's lots, it's the same fear we had with every new technological wave, right? Every, like, there's the people who love it and who push for it, and then there's people who, like, get scared and, like, try to just find a reason why we cannot do something. And I always get enticed when somebody tells me I cannot do something, because that usually just means that there is room for growth for us as a society. And so we do a lot of handholding and a lot of education in the market, because most people we're dealing with have never dealt with an AI contract, have never dealt with actual AI, because everybody now is AI, but you know, there's the difference between actual AI and, as you said, 10,000 people in a third world country coding something, right? Mm-hmm. So I think data security is very important, but it doesn't mean you cannot use AI. And I think it's a layer of education that is slowly dripping into our industry that people understand AI is something that I can use even under the umbrella of data security. I just need to know how.
It's been pretty obvious over the years, though, not as many startups have thought it security first and delivery second. And if security's not at the beginning, then it's not a priority and it's never going to make it all the way in. So it's really cool to hear how that philosophy was different for you guys, especially given that you went enterprise and you can always go smaller, but you adding security on to catch up never actually fills those holes. You're always chasing. And so it's great to hear that perspective. So see, I knew, Rob, that was the thing that got me in that article from you.
It's definitely interesting things to think about. So brave new times with this AI, right?
Yeah.
All right. The second. Ooh, that Jeff, that's going to be the nugget for the show. I'm going to have to reframe and rewire my whole brain to start saying IA.
IA. I like this. Yeah. That's going to be a hard one, but hey, why not? Changing vernacular.
Intelligence augmentation, you know. Don't say already. It's nothing is artificial. There's nothing artificial in AI.
Yeah. It is. It's going to be, yeah, that's going to be the one we got to retrain people. Mm. Intelligence augmentation. I have it written here. So we'll have to make sure we get that nugget out there.
Brilliant.
I think I stole all this, right, by the way, from the founder of Alice Technologies. So this is not me. I need to give credit where credit is due.
It's all good. We none of us have actually really made up any of the stuff along the way. We've probably heard it somewhere else. It's just, you know, make sure it gets out there.
It's that good old R&D, right? Good old R&D. All right. So the second story I had today, let's talk a little bit about safety. So I was looking at EHS today. So this article is technology that can prevent worker injuries. And this is coming to us through the National Safety Council. So they do a lot of research and they recently released Safety Technology 2024. So it's an interesting report. If you use the show notes, you can go to their website. And if you give them that email address, they'll give you the report. So for your benefit, I've downloaded the report if you don't want to give them your email. There are some interesting key findings. So they're talking about safety and technology, and there's five of them. The first one that I thought was interesting to really talk about is fatigue remains the most likely exposure across industries, and it was reported as a top contributor to injuries in the workplace. So in construction, right? This is one of the most physically demanding occupations on the planet. We are physically lifting materials, we're in different elements, the weather, a lot of things. We'll pause there. Across all surveyed technologies, employers reported increased technology applicability and consideration. So we're looking at more tech. Additionally, 83% of employees agreed that they were open to trying to using new safety technology, which that's a good thing, right? Versus old school paper forms. And then the last one, though, this one's kind of disturbing, Jeff and Sarah. Number five, purchase cost remains a key barrier in adopting safety technology for employers. That's the one that just blows me away. Of last year, I was talking with somebody that runs a mental fitness training program site called Headversity. And he actually pointed out that, you know, all due respect, the construction industry is great at PPE, personal protective equipment. There's millions of dollars spent every year on hard hats, or now the helmet shift and the boots. But mindset, that was kind of weird where he was talking about. In a lot of conversations I've had over the past year, when it comes to safety, still money is still such a barrier of people saying, well, you know, this is how we've always done it. Or do we really need that when it comes to safety? And Jeff, this is going way back, right? I think it's still kind of like this. When I'm looking at these key findings from this report, fatigue's an issue, hasn't changed much. Technology adoption's going up. That's good. And Sarah, from your side of the table, I'm curious, this purchase thing, right? This report is saying that companies don't want to spend a lot of money on safety. While we're recognizing we've got problems with the work and everything else, have you seen anything with the customers that you're working with or in the general market that you're at? Is purchase power still a barrier for improving safety?
Yeah, I have very problematic data on that, actually. So like, I have problematic data from what I've done in the past, where it was very clear that the way the ROI for safety tool is calculated is not necessarily saving human lives, but actually like reduction in insurance costs and stuff like that, right? Which that is just absurd. Again, capitalism, right? The other thing that is like, one of the agents that we have is a productivity agent, right? That actively like incentivizes the tradespeople to work faster, safer, better. And so we see how much money they, you know, customers spend on each of these categories, and safety is the smallest category that gets incentivized, right? So like that data is, and it's not just out here, like the data is just out there, right? Like we emphasize it for, you know, publicly, we want it all, but when it comes down to actively like paying for it, like there's a few companies that absolutely do this, right? And like, you know, and then there's a few that are just calculating an ROI. And there's no ROI in human life, but that's my opinion.
No, I would agree with your opinion. There is no ROI. And it is so troubling when you're sitting there, sitting down, and I've done this over the years consulting, and they're like, okay, well, how can this affect our EMR? And how can that reduce our costs? And that's where you're focused on. I'm like, is that really what you're focused on? Like, I've sat across from people and and been, you know, I hate ROI studies, by the way, first and foremost. It's return on implementation to me. If you want to do anything, what's the return on it? The return on it is somebody goes home, right? And doesn't not go home today. And that should always be it. But I've worked in other spaces where it's like, oh, how do you quantify a mistake you never make, right? On the rework, how do you quantify that 65%? It's like that one miss could be all the money back. Why we don't say that when it comes to human life, I don't understand that. Because if you put that on every job site, no job could make it. And it's really important to our industry, and it's still one of our problems, right? We still have a lot of safety and mental health and other concerns for our people on the job site. Now, I don't want to end it in all negative, because I have been out watching some of the things that are being produced that are awesome, that I'm starting to see be palatable for people to buy. I always go back to Hilti and their exoskeleton and what they've done with it. Mm-hmm. I have now worn it 4 times from its inception to today. It has it is so comfortable. It is so easy to use. I have a permanently separated shoulder, so I can't work over my head for long. In that thing, I can do things over my head for way longer than I ever could before. And then now it's got things to attach tools to lift the tools for me, to spread the tool weight across your body weight. Exoskeletons have made other ones that can attach to lifts, because one of the bigger problems is, great, if I use this tool and I use it correctly and forward in front of me, I can use it for a particular amount of time. But how many times am I up on a lift working around a corner doing something I really shouldn't do? That if that thing kicks, I'm going to be lucky if I'm the only one it hurts, right? So in this perspective, you can work around a corner because the lift is holding it and the device itself is managing. And if a kick happens, it's there to absorb it and control it. So those are the areas that I want to see from a physical and a fatigue perspective really get a lot of noise. And it's not robotic. We love to call it robotic. Sure, if that's hot and that gets your investors to invest in it, say it all you want. I'll be behind it and call it a robot with you. It's just an augmentation. It's just a bigger, different tool. And that's where I want to see a lot of these groups focus. Yes, I want to see them get the technology for the right reasons, but look at our people and invest that money, because I've heard some staggering numbers of the number of people that are going to leave our industry soon.
Yeah, for every one new person coming in, 5 are leaving, right?
Like 4 or 5, right? Yeah. I saw something like 40% of our workforce is going to be gone by, I thought it was like 2030 or something. And I'm like, this is such a scary time that if you don't invest, there's a possibility you don't exist. Like, people don't like to talk about that. They don't like to talk about money. Look, change is optional. So is survival. It's up to you. Yeah. You decide. Well, Rob, I love it. Thank you as always for bringing the stuff this morning. I'm going to jump in and talk a little robots here. I found this one on CNBC. Meet the AI powered robots that big tech thinks can solve a global labor shortage. Mm. I thought this was interesting because, you know, I had a long discussion with Jonathan Marsh one time about, you know, where is AI really going to have some of its more tangible impacts? And, you know, we discussed a lot of what, you know, you're doing with it, Sarah, and a lot of what some of these other folks are doing to really be intelligence augmentation for people. But the physical display of AI is when it goes into automated systems that can do the jobs that we don't have enough of today, right? If you look at restaurants, if you look at fast food, if you look at all sorts of service areas, they are looking for ways to augment people because they can't get enough of them to do the job. And our population is growing, and we're not keeping up. So this is about Tesla, Amazon, Microsoft, NVIDIA putting billions of dollars into what are known as humanoid robots. Mm-hmm. Machines that stand on 2 legs designed to perform certain tasks that people currently do. The thing about it was they could only in the past program them to do certain things, and it was very specific. Now that the technology has come around to allow for what is so hard in some of these environments is there are variables that a pre-programmed robot could never deal with that now AI and computer vision and a lot of the other things, Sarah did a good job of talking about this, that it, there's way more than generative AI and large language models. There's a ton of things that can now come together, including computer vision, to allow these humanoid robots to do more for us. And there's a ton of people investing in the technology. And I think it's fantastic because you're not going to have, I love Atlas and I love the cool videos of it running around, but it's a multi-million dollar machine. And we're not going to hire it to go get tools from the truck and come back to us. It's just not like efficient. Where can we put these little robots? Are in fast food joints. I saw one too that was really crazy. It's a, we covered this recently. It's a trailer that can drive up, drop off, and sell things from inside of it, like a convenience store or a food truck. And I was thinking, like, how cool would that be for a job site that it has that? So I'm kind of interested, Sarah, in how you think about, you know, a humanoid type robot being powered with some of the new technology we have, doing some of these tasks that we don't have enough people to do.
I mean, we already there, right? That's not even like, I mean, the technology is there. It might not be fully productized, right? It's always the same we say about our software. It's like 70% of the bureaucratic work on a job site can be automated with the tech we have today. It's not productized yet, right? There's always a difference. Is the technology there and is it a picture perfect product? And I think when it comes to robots, a lot of the technology is fully there. If you think about self-driving cars, without like the legislation and like, oh, we are scared and like whatsoever, but they are driving, like they're driving, they're reacting, like they're maneuvering, they're like, you know, there's no questions that that technology exists. And all, a lot of what that is like the computer vision, as you said, combining that with real-time analytics and then making decisions based on the data that these robots and self-driving cars capture from the real world and from the knowledge base that they have on like how should that reactive XYZ happens, right? And the XYZ is happening through computer vision. So that the robots are there, is we know them, we have been in self-driving cars, right? And so now it's just about translating them into more non-repetitive tasks, right? Which is really why I think construction is lagging behind versus like some fast food restaurant, whatever, because it's more repetitive tasks and we have it in construction and the environment is more friendly, right? But it's dusty and so on. And we necessarily, there's also lots of people who just don't want robots on site, right? There's amazing stories about people treating them really poorly on a job site. And that's why they are not working, right? It's like, it's the same from the military. I don't know. I've heard crazy stories about the best fighter jets and then people just draw something funny on them. And that's why it destroyed the whole like fighter jet, right? So there's just like human nature that has to slowly be brought up to speed of what's happening in the technology world, which is always something we have had to happen. But I think it's interesting where this is going. I do not believe, for example, that we can build a whole construction site fully just with robots anytime soon. I personally haven't seen anything that would let me believe this. There's a few great, there's Dusty Robotics and a few of the others that are great at doing that one repetitive job phenomenally better than the humans, everything cheaper and so on. Like that's all cool. But until we have a humanoid perfect robot that can do the fine skills between, I don't know, screwing in a screw and then in the same moment, like painting something. And it's just like a variation of human task that isn't there yet. But I agree with you that the combination of technological advancement in computer vision, in real-time processing power, in the data analytics that we have right now, I can see a world where we just watch people do all these jobs for like a while and train the robotics models. Like there's a lot of like robotics AI that's coming out right now that we train these through computer vision, but like how does the human do it? Can I replicate this in a machine and then actually be have a very versatile construction robot? I think that is coming, but it's going to be a while.
Yeah. And I think the things in the phases before that are exactly what you talked about. You're going to be intelligently augmented by something that can go get something for you or can assist you in what you're doing. And those advancements are look, we're going to get better and better at offsite. Less and less people are going to be needed to do the job because we have less and less people to do the jobs. And so, yes, we will be using less people on site, but they'll just be augmented by new tools. And it's funny you bring up Dusty because you ever seen Dusty Robotics? It has two eyeballs on it.
Ew.
The reason they put it on there was some of those stories you're talking about. They had to make it. They had to make it look a little cuter so you didn't want to beat it up.
Yeah.
Rob, I'm interested. We've been talking about this for years, and now to see, you know, Amazon, Tesla, some of the others, Microsoft, Nvidia, obviously get involved in this, it's got to drive a little interest on your side.
I think there's definitely a place for these humanoid type robots in the construction industry, because there are some extremely unsafe work roles, right? Like, let's think confined space, putting people down in occupied sewers, manholes, things of that nature, where now we have to go through all these checkdowns and protocols. Or for our friends in the electrical world, right? Hot work. No one wants to do hot work. When you look at an electrical company's form to do hot work, it's crazy the checkdowns they go through. And it's still, they can put all that PPE on a human, but if there's an arc, if you've ever seen the horrible videos of survivors. So I think there's a place there to really look at, like, what's really super dangerous? Hot work, chemical work, underground, how about high angle work? You know, there's probably a place to figure it out. Now the question is, how do you get the price point down to put a robot underground in a confined space, or that really deep trench that it's a little sketchy to do that water tie-in? Or, I don't know, with some of the claims out there, maybe it does make sense to get a humanoid robot and put them in an electrical room when you're having to do hot work at a hospital or a data center or some owner that's like, nope, can't turn it off. All right, well, we're not going to put a human in there because humans are kind of hard to replace. But you know what? We'll take a hit to that $500,000 robot.
Well, and the cool part here, Rob, is that the investment in doing this in other spaces drives competition, which drives down price. Because they look for manufacturing efficiencies, and this is an economy of scale. That's why I want to see it done other places and get traction, because that will drive down the overall costs. And then, you know, a $500,000 robot comes all the way down to a $50,000 robot, because there's enough of them out there that we can do these things with them. And those are, you named the exact spaces that we need to be focused on. But we need these other investments, and we need this other these other markets to push forward, which will help drive down that cost.
But I also feel we're not that far away. Like in construction, again, it sounds so black and white, right? Like either you have robots or you have tools. As like most of the tools that we have in construction already have robotic, right? Like if I look at a modern like excavator or something like that, like there's so much technology and stuff like that. And yes, a human is still driving it, but so a human is also telling a robot to bring something. So where is really the line between like robots and very sophisticated tools, right? And so I feel like it's going to be a blurry step-by-step process again to get us there. And if you look at mining, for example, I think mining is a great example where most of the mining, at least the big companies, are very automated, and it's just beautiful. But you still have humans somewhere in a central office sitting in front of like 16 screens, like playing computer games, right? And it's like, okay, that's what the mining industry turned into. And it's probably somewhere where we end up as well eventually.
Trucking is heading there. You know, there's lots of places headed there where that's what it's going to be. And I will tell you, my 16-year-old son would probably not look at construction if he's looking at certain things. But if it was like, hey, here's a PlayStation type game controller and a machine, and you're going to control it, and this is what you're going to build, he's going to go like, sign me up.
Yeah.
Sign me up. I'm in. Let's go. So yeah, it's great. My last one's going to be quick and easy. I just wanted to give a shout out because I saw this week. There's a lot of talk about, you know, are we continuing to invest? Are we going to see new startups and new continued investment in construction technology? And there's been people that are a little bit afraid, but this is cool. Contec Backer launches second $100 million fund. So Iron Spring Ventures, which was the backers behind Document Crunch and a bunch of others, has just opened up a new fund to invest in those really early stage startups. They're like a $2 to $4 million size startup, you know, that early phase where, you know, people need a little bit of cash flow, injected cash flow, because they've got some ideas and they've got some places to go. And I wanted to call out that, you know, Adam Brigman and the team at Iron Spring has been really thoughtful in the process and the way they've invested in companies and what they're really about. You know, at their core, they're about exorbitant material prices, skilled labor shortage, infrastructure stagnation, supply chain stalls, and then, you know, just the clunky old construction operating systems that we work on. So it was great to see that they've seen enough and enough value in what they're doing and where they're pushing to bring another fund online and you know, maybe give a couple of really good startups out there an opportunity to grow and be backed in a way that works, give them time to work through their problems and get to good solutions. So Rob, I thought, you know, might as well give them a shout out that the money's coming back and it's not gone.
No. It's the fuel a lot of companies need to grow, right? It's a challenge every founder's got to look through. Like, how am I going to grow this company? There's the old school bootstrap, but there's also, hey, when there's the right opportunity, how do you take an infusion?
I actually think construction tech is hotter than it has ever been. Like, from the channelist space, I see we get so much inbound from channelists, which that didn't happen a few years ago, right? Like now, like the Sequoias and the Chem Catalyst of this world and whoever is like, this is an interesting category. And I'm like, yes, it's 10% of GDP. You're right.
Well, it is. It's all of that. And it's been a scary space for them. And they've heard a lot of negative news over time. And I think that's one of the cool parts about this show and what we do is it's like, no, it's positive news. Like it's a really high opportunity. But really valuable. Sarah, you did a really good job of saying this, and I say it over and over again. People in construction in the built environment need to keep their heads up because nobody goes through a day, I don't think, without consuming it in some way, shape, or form. Like you said, a bridge, a road, a sidewalk, your house, your apartment, your office, all of that. None of it happens. You don't get to do any of it if we don't have the women and men that build in our world and make it a reality. So it's a great space to be in. Congrats to the team at Iron Spring and look forward to some new technology companies out there. And with that, I got to wrap it up today. Sarah, thank you so much for sitting down with us. Let the audience know where they can go learn a little bit more about what you're building and what the team at Trunk Tools is doing.
TrunkTools.com. Just sign up there or reach out to me or anybody from my team on LinkedIn or you find us on every conference. So it's easy to get to us if we haven't already tried to get to you.
That's awesome. Rob, it's always awesome to sit down with you. Thanks for doing another round with me today.
Hey, it's always good to have great conversations and meet people like Sarah. It was awesome to talk to you. Thank you for learning more about your background and your story and your mission going forward. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in today to geek out for our interview with Dr. Sarah Buckner. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is The Contech Crew, signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.